morning, everyone. Judge Wynn and I would like to welcome again and thank Judge Behan for sitting with us from the Eastern District of Louisiana. Thank you, Judge Behan.
Thank you.
First case is submitted on the briefs, United States v. Kerr. The first case on calendar for argument is Anderson v. Tukar.
Good morning, Your Honor. Walter K. Pyle on behalf of Mr. Eric Anderson. Eric Anderson and a co-defendant, Randy Salazar, were on trial for a murder. During this trial, the prosecutor had subpoenaed the co-defendant's girlfriend, but she refused to testify, even though the court held her in contempt. The prosecutor persuaded the court to allow her to put the witness, Yami Serrano, on the stand in front of the jury to show that she wouldn't answer the questions. Except that wasn't all she did when she put the witness on the stand. Before the witness was in front of the jury, there was an examination of the witness, and the prosecutor asked her, "Do you know Randy Salazar? He's just been at a white night hotel with him." But when she watched the witnesses on the stand, the prosecutor didn't even ask if she knew Randy Salazar. He said, Mrs. Serrano, isn't it true that in late September or early October, Randy Salazar told you that he and Eric Anderson were out looking for a car to jack or rob, and they saw a guy who didn't look like he'd fight back, and he looked kind of dorky, and Eric Anderson got out of the car with a gun, and he wrestled with the guy, and he ended up shooting him as he stood by the side of the car?"
Counsel, would that have been an improper question if it were answered?
Yes, involved improper hearsay. As it relates to Eric Anderson, yes, it was in effect six leading questions combined into one very inflammatory.
If she had answered the question, would it have been hearsay? It would have been hearsay because it related what he told her.
Yes.
But that's not testimonial.
Well, it is testimony because everything that's in that question was extracted from Yami Serrano in an interview in the Aviak Police Department. They asked her all of that. That's the only place they got that information, was in a police interview.
But the question itself didn't asked her whether a non-testimonial statement was made to her, right?
The Supreme Court tells us that the Sixth Amendment was directed toward ex parte examinations.
My question was, was she asked about a non-testimonial statement that was made to her?
She was asked a question that was obtained by a testimonial means that also included a hearsay statement by Randy Salazar implicating the defendant, and that part to her
was not testimonial.
Was not testimonial, except it was, because it was extracted by the police from Yami Serrano when they questioned her in the police department.
Well, my question to you is, how is it a clearly unreasonable application of Supreme Court law? The Supreme Court has never held that a prosecutor is leaving questions to a witness about non-testimonial hearsay. Was a confrontation?
Well, I dispute that it's not testimony. When you extract evidence from a witness ex parte, it doesn't become non-testimonial because part of it was hearsay. That's simply another reason to think it's improper.
But the Ninth Circuit in United States v. Tsai had a situation where the prosecutor asked leading questions about a judicial opinion, which was hearsay. And the Ninth Circuit said the line of questioning was clearly wrong, it was clearly prosecutorial misconduct, but the judicial opinion was non-testimonial, and therefore it was not a confrontation problem. So I understand your argument, but I'm trying to understand how it would be a clearly unreasonable application of Supreme Court law to conclude that this is not a confrontation clause problem.
Well, simply because the Crawford analysis, our confrontation clause was directed to the use of ex parte examinations as evidence in court. And all that, 100% of that question was the result of an ex parte examination that was just in court in the mouth of the prosecutor, just as if she were wearing a wig and a regular robe and speaking in a 17th century British accent.
Okay, well, if assuming that's true, then it's a confrontation clause problem is not categorically incurable with instructions. You agree with that, right?
I theoretically. Except that Bruton versus the United States says in some context you can give a jury instruction and it will cure the error, but not in the context in Bruton, which is exactly the same context here, with a powerfully incriminating extrajudicial statements of a co-defendant who stands accused side by side with the defendant are deliberately spread before the jury in a joint trial. In that situation,
what harm did it cause? It might have been pretty compelling. I would say overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case.
Well, it wasn't overwhelming in the first trial because the jury didn't convict. Second, every one of the witnesses that testified that the defense made incriminating statements to them, all of them had been accused of the police, threatened by the police, to be charged with the murder.
But there was also identification testimony by a non-involved witness. There was some DNA on the clothes. There was some identification of Anderson is driving the vehicle on a video. I mean, it was more than just those other confessions that corroborated his involvement.
Apparently, the eyewitness showed a six-pack of photos, including Eric Anderson. He picked somebody else as potentially the person involved. He didn't pick out Eric Anderson until that same photo was published in the local newspaper.
But he later testified, and the jury accepted that he was confident that he identified the right people.
Well, we don't know how much the jury accepted of that testimony. The jury may well have accepted the testimony of the prosecutor.
Yeah, you're putting a lot of stock in the fact that there was a hung jury the first time, but the composition of the jury makes a lot of difference as to how, but to set the issue is how strong is the evidence, because the composition of the jury can change. The evidence has to be.
But Ninth Circuit law, as we cited in our reply brief, said that's pretty strong evidence that it was a close case.
Ninth Circuit has also said that you can't read too much into a hung jury.
Well, they said two things. I think you can say that in that particular case you're talking about, the testimony is quite different. There's 47 pages in one of a transcript of testimony in one trial, and only 13 pages in the other.
I think we've got to look at the evidence in total. The fact that there was an eyewitness who identified him with 98% certainty. So you can parse the different pieces of evidence and say, well, you know, this witness is problematic in some other ways, but then you couple that with the DNA evidence and the video footage.
The DNA evidence shows the decision.
Well, sure. I mean, you can parse each piece of evidence, but I think we've got to look at it in total to determine the harmlessness.
I'm running low on time. Let me say one other thing. The trial was unfair because in the, as the appellate court decision said, the prosecutor introduced evidence that Yami Shimano had said she had a conversation with Randy Salazar. In the preliminary hearing, she said, I didn't have a conversation. The court didn't hear, the jury didn't hear that part. In her examination, she said, I lied because I was scared. The jury didn't hear that. It was a non-adversarial trial on those issues.
Counsel, if we disagree with you regarding the testimonial nature of her statements, do you lose?
No, because it was an unfair trial, because it was not an adversarial trial. The prosecutor was able to introduce evidence of this statement, but the defense was not able to introduce evidence where Yami Shimano said, I made that statement.
Was that argument made to the state in the state habeas petition?
I don't recall. The due process argument, it's a due process argument, we're saying it's an unfair trial, and both due process and confrontation issues were raised in the state court.
All right, thank you, counsel.
be a different situation if the prosecutor asked Ms. Serrano about her conversation with police, certainly. But here, the prosecutor only asked about her conversation with Mr. Zofi.
He was clearly suggesting that someone had told him that she said that and was suggesting to the jury that, as a fact, she had told someone that. And the defense did not get to cross-examine her on whether she, in fact, told anybody that.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct.
And her statement to the police was testimonial.
Yes, yes, her statement to the police was, but not Mr. The declarant in this case is Mr. Salazar, and his conversation with Ms. Serrano was not. So the problem in this case, the way I see it, that I want to help you out, is that it's the leading questions and perhaps the first few, which came in without objection. And as it was pointed out, certainly if she had suddenly changed her mind on the stand and decided to discuss her conversation, then that would have been admissible, and well, certainly then there wouldn't have been a confrontation clause issue.
And also, just so we're on the same page, we certify the following question: whether the prosecutor committed misconduct by improperly presenting false testimony obtained through coercion, by improperly questioning witnesses who refused to testify, or by relying on the improper questions in closing argument. So is your argument regarding Crawford in the context of whether the prosecutor committed misconduct? If the prosecutor violated Crawford, would that be misconduct?
Well, the issue is whether she committed misconduct or whether she deprived Mr. Anderson of a fair trial. So that's the question. The only reason I really went into the Crawford issue is because Mr. Anderson went into it in such detail. But
my question was, if there were Crawford error, would that be misconduct?
Could be, certainly. Right. Yes. If a prosecutor is asking about testimonial hearsay,
prosecutorial misconduct has to raise a habeas claim, it's got to violate constitutional rights. It's got to be a due process violation of some kind, and due process includes the right to confrontation. So I don't see how the confrontation clause issue is not before us by virtue of certification. It was clearly raised below. It was raised in the state courts. I think that the argument that all that was asked to be briefed was prosecutorial misconduct as its due process violation for just bad conduct and not the confrontation clause issue as well.
Okay, I see that they're intertwined. And so the argument is,
so there was problems. But the question is couched in terms of presenting false testimony obtained through coercion. That's not a Crawford issue.
That was actually a completely separate claim that was not addressed in the opening brief, and so I didn't address it in my brief, and it wasn't addressed in the reply either. That claim was the first claim, and it had to do with Michael Johnson. Because Michael Johnson submitted a declaration and said the prosecutor put out all this false testimony, so on and so forth. And the district court discussed that in its ruling. So it's in the ER under, I think, the very first part of the district court's ruling. But
can I ask a different question? Really, just to clarify the state's position, do you see misconduct here? And if so, where is the prosecutorial misconduct on this record? Is it with regards to the confrontation clause, the closing argument, the coercive testimony? Where is the misconduct on this record, according to the state?
Well, when this case is before this court on habeas corpus, so this court's decision is based on the state court's decision. So at this point, the procedure is, I'm not defending what the prosecutor did, I'm defending the state court
within the state court's ruling, and then the state court also said, but because of the instructions, because of, I mean, multiple instructions, because of the evidence, because of the cumulative nature of the testimony, and so on and so forth, it was not, well, it didn't deprive him of a fair trial. And so that is the issue before this court, is was that objectively unreasonable? So there's just many layers, but right now, for here, that's what this court needs to decide, and that's where, that's the position I'm arguing.
So you're arguing that it was validly cured, that misconduct was cured by the instructions, is that what your argument is?
Well, in addition to other things, that it didn't deprive them of a fair trial, and for a number of reasons, including the multiple instructions. And so, therefore, the Bruton issue, and I do see how those kind of can combine, but in Bruton, in Douglas, in all these various, those cases that talk about when you're trying co-defendants together, you're spreading the evidence before the jury, and you're saying you can consider this confession from this guy, but not the other person. This is admissible evidence, and you need to decide whether his confession was true, but don't consider it at all for the other guy. Well, Bruton says, no, you can't do that. The jury can't rationally do that. But in this case, the jury was instructed multiple times, don't consider this evidence. Questions of attorneys are not evidence. And that was kind of a recurring theme throughout the trial. And I think it was very clear that it was not evidence they were to consider it. And the defense, I think both attorneys did a good job saying, no, you're not supposed to look at this. So the instructions were a big part of it, but then also the strength of the evidence. Because like in Douglas, there was basically no other evidence. But here there was eyewitness testimony, DNA testimony, and this court can consider the cumulative nature of all of that evidence to find no error in the state court ruling. So I'm prepared to submit.
All right, thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Counsel suggested that if the prosecutor had asked the question in a different way, it might have been a violation. I submit to you that artfully worded questions don't change the fact that the obvious amount of statements the police was testimonial. It does not become untestimonial because it contains a conversation with her boyfriend. Whereas the misconduct, no reasonable prosecutor could think that answering that question was proper. I was a prosecutor many years ago. The judge would have probably called my supervisor and discussed my conduct in his courtroom. But prosecutors today take a calculated risk that an appellate court will save their conviction. And sometimes it works, as it did in this case. The Constitution is only effective if the courts enforce its provisions. We ask you to reverse the conviction.